Good afternoon and welcome to a Juno Afternoon here for Wednesday, the 20th of September of the year 2017. Jeff Brown will be your host for today. Today we'll be talking with Kaya Hendrickson about activities at the City Museum. We'll get a preview of this Wednesday's speaker for the Juno World Affairs Council, Dr. Carlos Gaspin Llanos. Kim Kiefer will be here with details about rotary bulbs. I will talk with Guinness record holder Al Glenicke, holds the record for the world's fastest tongue. Night Riders Almanac, Caperna, and more on a Juno Afternoon. The forecast for today, patchy fog later on this morning, otherwise cloudy skies. Forecast for Thursday night and Friday, rain.
This is National Native News. I'm Hannah Colton, in for Antonia Gonzalez. Members of the Yankton Sioux tribe are protesting the alleged use of excessive force by two law enforcement officers that left a tribal elder bloodied and bruised. In a statement, tribal chairman Robert Flying Hawk says 64-year-old Raymond Knoyer Sr. was rushing to be with his dying mother early Sunday. KSFY reports a trooper attempted to stop Knoyer for speeding. The incident turned into a confrontation outside the mother's nursing home. The tribe says Knoyer told the trooper he was going to see his mother. They say the trooper then grabbed him and a city police officer, Eli Coleman, slammed him to the ground face first and tased him. The Argus Leader reports Coleman is an uncertified officer who had been with the police department less than a year. The South Dakota Highway Patrol in a statement said they'd reviewed the trooper's actions and found them to be professional and compliant with policy. The State Attorney General and Division of Criminal Investigation are looking into the incident. The Osage Nation has secured a legal victory in a years-old dispute over the development of a wind farm on tribal land. The U.S. 10th Circuit Court of Appeals Monday reversed a 2015 ruling in the company's favor. The Tulsa World reports the tribe has long opposed the project, which put more than 80 turbines over an 8,000-acre area in Osage County. A three-judge panel ruled the company neglected to get necessary federal approval for construction work that constituted mineral development. This week's ruling allows the Osage Nation to seek damages for unauthorized development. An Albuquerque museum has rededicated a century-old totem pole that was taken from a Canadian village more than 70 years ago. Tribal leaders and the family of the totem pole carver reached an agreement with the museum to restore it and keep it where it is. Andy Murphy reports.
A totem pole stands out of place in the middle of Albuquerque, New Mexico. For Tlawitza's First Nation chief, Daniel Smith, it's an odd place for a totem pole to be.
You know, it's kind of weird that it's way out here that there's a totem pole that's sitting out in the middle of a desert.
The 40-foot pole is inside the Hibben Center for Archaeology Research at the University of New Mexico. That's because it was stolen from the Smith family and the Tlawitza Nation in Canada.
In May of 1941, the pole had gone missing. It was towed to Alaska and then trailered from Alaska to here, to the center.
Chief Smith and his family came to the University of New Mexico for a blessing and celebration of the totem pole. Dr. Leah McChesney, curator of ethnology at the Maxwell Museum of Anthropology, was instrumental in helping to right past wrongs.
We have developed new documents that recognize the Smith family and the Tlawitza Nation hold title to the pole.
The totem pole will stay at the Hibben Center for practical reasons, Chief Daniel Smith explains.
It would never survive the trip home, but there will be a replica made.
The totem pole represents the Smith family's history. It's made up of seven figures. An ancestor holds up an owl, a grizzly bear, a gray whale, a wolf, a noble man, and a kingfisher. For National Native News, I'm Andy Murphy.
A massive British tapestry slated for an upcoming 400th anniversary of the Mayflower's Plymouth voyage is under scrutiny for racist depictions of Native Americans. The BBC reports the National Congress of American Indians director Jacqueline Pata says the New World tapestry depicts indigenous people as, quote, subhuman warlike savages. The designer maintains there's nothing racist about the cartoonish figures, which are based off drawings from the 16th century. With National Native News, I'm Hannah Colton.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by the law offices of Sanofsky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Monkman, a national tribal rights law firm with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska.
Yacht Aid, support by the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce Convention and Tourism Department, providing complete convention and visitor planning services to Native American conventions. Information on convention and tourism services at fiabq.org.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
It's 6 minutes past the hour, and you're tuning in to Juneau Afternoon. Our first guest is Kaya Henriksen from the Juneau Douglas City Museum. Kaya, thank you for coming by today.
Thank you.
So, what's happening?
Well, we are gearing up for our fall programming season, which will be starting that first weekend in October. And it begins with First Friday. So we will be open late for First Friday from 4:30 to 7 to have an acquisition reception for the painting Bend in the River by Sidney Lawrence. So the painting will be on display starting that day and through the end of October. And this is a new acquisition. It was donated to the museum in memory of William D. DeArmond. And we're really excited to have it. So it's a great opportunity to come see a new Sidney Lawrence painting. He's one of Alaska's most prominent painters. And this painting was actually painted somewhere in Juneau, probably in the flats out near the airport.
Now, I was reading the newsletter from the Sidney Museum, and you described looking at photocopies of the picture, but when you saw it in person, it was much more of an impression.
Yes. So as the person who does a lot of the press for the City Museum, I often see a photo or a picture of our paintings before they go on display. And it's just so much more impressive to see it in real life, especially with Sidney Lawrence, because so much of his painting has to do with his use of light. And it's hard to capture that in a photograph. And when you see it, when you're standing before it, you can really pick out those subtle details. So it's it should be quite a nice event in addition to the museum's collection.
And it's going on First Friday?
That's going on First Friday, yep, October 6th from 4:30 to 7. And we will also have on view for that First Friday portions of the USS Juneau Silver Service set. So we have had that on exhibit in the past. It's on loan to us from the Navy, thanks to a lot of efforts from the Mendenhall Flying Lions. And so portions of the set will be going back on display, along with some historical information about the USS Juneau CL-52, which was sunk during the Battle of Guadalcanal. So that will also be available for people to view starting on First Friday and lasting through mid-April.
And you also have coffee and collections coming up in a couple of weeks.
We do. So on Saturday the 7th, our first coffee and collections of the season will be Elfrida Nord, who will be talking about the history of the Juneau Garden Club. So she is the self-appointed historian for the Garden Club, and she's been an active member since the late 1990s. And she has been researching the Garden Club's history. And she said that because of some new equipment that they have at the new State Library, she was actually able to uncover some documentation that they hadn't seen before. And so she's going to be presenting on her research so far. It's an ongoing project for her, but it should be quite interesting. The program will be from 2 to 4 p.m., which is later in the afternoon than we normally have coffee and collections. So if you're a regular coffee and collections goer, just make sure that you note that to come a little bit later in the afternoon. And again, it is a free event. And thanks to a generous donation from Heritage Coffee Company, we're able to offer free delicious coffee from them. And actually, starting in October, we will have free admission thanks to the Pioneers of Alaska Men's and Women's Igloo Number 6. So that's all the hours that we're open. We'll be going back to our fall and winter hours starting September 28th. So we'll be open Tuesday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m.
How's the summer been?
It's been very busy, but we've had a lot of visitors to the museum. We've had a lot of local people come on our walking tours, especially some of the specialized ones that we had on Treadwell and geology and the cemetery. So it feels like there's been a lot going on, and it's just going to continue as we start our fall programs. So we'll be having coffee and collections about once a month. First Fridays, we have a lot of great solo artists shows coming up this fall. We're going to have a retrospective of art of Sharon Lobau in November. In December, Mercedes Munoz will have an exhibit of ceramics. We'll have work by the Tsimshian carver Abel Ryan in January and February. And then in March is our ever-popular 12x12, and the theme for this year's 12x12 is seasons. So if anybody wants to get started on their piece early, you can get your creative juices going and think about a piece that's 12 inches by 12 inches on the topic of seasons.
Sounds fun. But how many entries do you get each year?
It really depends. Usually I think we get between 40 and 60. Sometimes if the theme is something that just really sparks a lot of interest, we'll have more, and sometimes it's less, but we find a way to fit them all in.
How do people find out more about the City Museum?
They can go to our website, so it's www.juno.org/library/museum. That's probably the best place, and you can also follow the Friends of the Museum on Facebook at it's just facebook.com/JunoMuseumFriends, so we post all our events there as well.
All right, anything you want to add that I might have forgotten to ask?
I just wanted to point out we do also have two new satellite exhibits. So our curator puts together exhibits for the Valley Library and Douglas Library. So the Valley Library exhibit right now is called History Mystery, and it's actually an interactive exhibit where we want people to write their own ideas for museum labels for the objects that are on display. And then at the Douglas Library, there is an exhibit on the 1936 landslide that happened in downtown Juneau. So there are some photos of the landslide and some historic text, as well as some first aid-related items from the museum's collection.
So where was the landslide?
So the landslide was on Franklin Street. And I believe that several people did die. It was a pretty devastating event.
Thanks for coming by the station today.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 20th of September, 2017. It's the birthday of the poet, essayist Donald Hall, Hamden, Connecticut, 1928. His most recent book, a collection called Essays After 80. It was when he was a young man, a student at Exeter. Donald Hall decided to become a writer. He'd loved horror movies as a kid, so he read Edgar Allan Poe and tried to write like him as well. He said, "I decided that I would be a poet for the rest of my life and started by working at poems for an hour or two every day after school. I never stopped." He said, "I love to work. And work in my life has meant only one thing, and that's a pen on the paper." It's the birthday of the famous editor Maxwell Perkins, born in New York City in 1884. He was the man who discovered F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, and Thomas Wolfe at a time when his fellow editors at Scribner's wanted to sign more experienced writers. Perkins looked for new talent. He was not good at spelling or punctuation, and he was a very slow reader, but he had a gift for spotting talent. His biggest challenge was Thomas Wolfe, who was an overwriter, unable to delete almost anything. He wrote his novel Of Time and the River standing up, using the top of a refrigerator for a desk, throwing each page into a box without editing or looking at it. Perkins had to go through the mess of papers and put them in some kind of order based on his best guess. Maxwell Perkins, who said, "An editor does not add to a book. At best, he serves as a handmaiden to an author." And it's the birthday of the poet and novelist Stevie Smith, born in East Yorkshire, England, 1902. Her name was Florence Margaret. Her family called her Peggy. But when she was a young woman, somebody told her that she reminded him of the jockey Steve Donahue, and she was Stevie. After that, she came out with a novel, 1936, Novel on Yellow Paper, which was very popular when it came out in 1936. Stevie Smith's most famous poem was Not Waving But Drowning, which a few years back was voted the second favorite poem in Great Britain. Here's a poem for today by Patrick Phillips, The Singing. I can hear her through the thin wall, singing, up before the sun, two notes, a kind of hushed, half-breathing. Each time the baby makes that little moan, can hear her trying not to sing, then singing anyway, a thing so old it might as well be Hittite or Minoan, and so soft no one would ever guess that I myself once sang that very song back when my son and then his brother used to cry all night or half the morning, though nothing in all the world was wrong. And now how strange to be the man from next door, listening as the baby cries, then quiets, cries, and quiets each time she sings their secret song that would sound the same 10,000 years ago and has no meaning but to calm. The Singing, a poem by Patrick Phillips from Elegy for a Broken Machine, published by Knopf and used by permission here on The Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse, back issues and subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's about 17 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned into it Juno Afternoon. Our next guest is Dr. Carlos Yapan-Yanos. He's a marine veterinarian and founder of ORCA, the Organization for Research and Conservation of Aquatic Animals. He'll be speaking tonight at 5 o'clock downstairs at 360 for the Juno World Affairs Council and offering an assessment of the ocean's health. Carlos, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Also in the studio with us is Carol Broderson with the World Affairs Council. You want to give us a brief update on the council?
Yes, we've got Carlos tonight, and then we're trying to get a gentleman out of Gaza to have him here in early October, and we're very excited for the presentations.
Yeah, I'm looking forward for it too.
Carlos, how are the oceans doing?
Well, the oceans are in a moment of critical condition in which we all have to do something for them, right? And the animals and the environment in general, the health of the environment that we in which we depend on, right? It's a stake here. Our own health is at stake. You know, the planets, you know, are 70% oceans. So whatever happens to them will affect us, all of us. So it have to be, you know, very important to pay attention to what the ocean is saying to us.
What kinds of things is it saying?
Well, first, well, there's too much pollution. There is oil spills happening in a constant daily basis. There is seismic testing going on that is just ruining the ears of several species of cetaceans. We're talking about the depletion of several locations in which there's depletion of fish and coral reefs that are deteriorating to the point of extinction in several areas of the planet, right? And diseases are emerging all over the world. The diseases that are affecting animals, marine mammals in particular, and that are happening to us as well, you know. Diseases like cancer or diabetes, you know, even bacterial diseases like tuberculosis are also happening to marine animals, right? And so diseases that we used to know affect humans are in the ocean now, and we have to pay attention to what is happening there because we're next.
What countries are the biggest offenders?
Where? Well, we're talking Northern Hemisphere countries because there's a lot of development. Development has to do a lot with it, whaling activities, large-scale fisheries activities, right, and the production of plastics basically all over the world, right, but mainly from the Northern Hemisphere countries. And then in the Southern Hemisphere countries, what we have is that lack of enforcement to regulate the impact brought from the North. You know, I mean, it's a mirror effect. So now that in the Northern Hemisphere we have all these long-term campaigns of education over the past, let's say, four decades, in the Southern Hemisphere, when we're having all this impact, we're just starting to have, you know, a little approach of what's going on, you know, and how people can get involved.
How did you become a marine veterinarian?
How did I become? Well,
and why?
Well, since I was very little, I found when I was 3 years old and during the first El Nino, something like that, and in Peru, I found a sea lion stranded, and it marked my life for life, you know, and I really wanted to focus on oceans and try to do something to help these animals, right? And I moved to Mexico. In Mexico, I met Keiko, the orca from Free Willy, and that also was another episode that was very, very intense to me. Right, because I saw shockingly how captivity affected the health of these animals, right? And I studied university in Peru, and then I moved to the United States to a specialization and training on marine mammalogy, and I decided to start something in Peru because the image of marine mammals in Peru was pretty much abandoned. Like, nobody really knew much about them. Like, dolphins were eaten, and sea lions were like a pest, and otters almost extinct. Marine otters are almost extinct. So I decided to start the organization down in Peru, try to change the fate of these animals, but also linking it to the public's health, which is part of my training.
Do you remember the first time you came face to face with a marine mammal?
Wow. Well, the first time was when I was very little. You know, when I saw this sea lion stranded in the beaches of Peru. But then, growing up, the first time probably when I have a sea lion in my hands was in California at the Marine Mammal Center near San Francisco, right, in Sausalito. And right directly, as soon as I arrived, the first thing I had to do is, like, tubing fish match to this sea lion. And that was it. I mean, the rest is history. I always remember that and cherish it.
You're involved in animal rescue. What are some typical situations?
Yes, animal rescue is one of the key messages that we transmit to the public because it's an education tool. Through example, we can get the public involved, but also to realize that there is a different way to associate, to relate to the animals and to the ocean. Remember, we're talking about marine animals here that people sometimes don't have an idea that they exist. You know, in the coast of Peru, Lima City has 10 million people living together in front of the ocean, the largest capital city of any country in the Americas, and the sea lions are the closest neighbor. Dolphins live there, whales live there, but people don't realize it. So we develop this stranded network of communications with different institutions and the public, involving schools as well into the rescue operations. And the typical situation will be of those sea lions that get stranded by losing their mother. Their mother can get entangled or directly suffer some kind of human attack because the depletion of fish in the coast have led into a higher competition with local fishermen for the local fish. And these orphans, these sea lions, are rescued all over the coast of Lima and taken to our South Pacific Marine Mammal Center, which when we deal with them, rehabilitate them, and after 3-4 weeks, place them back in the ocean. Once they learn how to eat fish, they gain weight, you know, they're in physical condition, optimal physical condition to swim again.
What can the average citizen do?
Excuse me?
What can the average citizen do?
The average citizen in general should start volunteering into these programs for ocean conservation in any place in the world. I mean, we need to get involved, be part of a solution. That's very important. What has happened in Peru is that the success of these programs has been the involvement of the public, you know, how the people have embraced the message but also become part of the message. The mouth-to-mouth, the example, the actions is what persons can do, starting with becoming a volunteer in any local group addressing, you know, like maybe beach cleanups, addressing, you know, campaigns to spread the word, you know, even online, you know, sharing messages about what's going on with the ocean. Acidification is a problem. The lack of oxygen, you know, is happening. It's real. Climate change is real as well, and we have to address it in the best way possible. And the best way is to be part of a solution, a practical solution, which is being spread there.
We're talking with Dr. Carlos Yaipinanos. He's speaking tonight at 5 o'clock at 360 downstairs from the KCUO building. What are you going to be talking about tonight?
I will be talking about how the general assessment of the ocean is starting from the coast of Peru. The oceans in Peru are particularly interesting, are important, because the largest atmospheric variation, oscillation, called El Niño, starts in the coast of Peru. And we all know now that El Niño has an impact all around the world. So it's important to see what's going on in that coast in particular. How's the health of the oceans there? Because that's the largest ecosystem. You know, the ocean is connected all around the world, and whatever happens in one location will affect the other location. You know, and it's just one planet that we have, and we have to cherish and learn from it as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Anything you'd like to add?
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity, Jeff, and for Carl, the Universal Affairs Council. And I hope that you can join us tonight. Hopefully you will see us online as well.
Yep.
And thank you very much.
I'd like to be under the sea in an octopus's garden in the shade. He'd let us in, knows where we've been, in his octopus's garden, in the shade. I'd ask my friends to come and see an octopus's garden with me. I'd like to be under the sea, in an octopus's garden, in the shade.
Warm below the storm, in our little hideaway beneath the waves, resting our heads on the seabed, in an octopus's garden near a cave. We would sing and dance around, because we know we can't be found.
I'd like to be under the sea, in an octopus's garden, in the shade.
About the coral that lies beneath the waves. Oh, what joy for every girl and boy, knowing they're happy and they're safe.
We would be so happy, you and me, no one there to tell us what to do. I'd like to be in an octopus's garden with you.
Support comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, featuring the new flagship cafe and bakery located at 130 Front Street in downtown Juneau. More information at heritagecoffee.com.
It's about 29 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned into it in the afternoon. Our next guest is Kim Kiefer, who's here to talk about rotary bulbs.
Yes, good afternoon, Jeff. How are you?
What a sunny day can bring a smile on everyone.
It can, and it is a beautiful day out there. A great day to think about bulbs.
So tell me about the Rotary, please.
Okay. So I'm with the Juneau Gastrointestinal Rotary Club, and our annual fundraiser is the Rotary Bulbs. So we sell bulbs and we'll deliver them, and people can pick them up on the 30th, the end of this month, Saturday. A number of people have already ordered the bulbs at at rotarybulbs.com. There's still some bulbs available, and we also have a garage sale on the 30th from 10 to 2 at AEL&P. And people can pick up the orders they already have purchased there. They can also look at what we have at the garage sale to purchase. And this year we added a bonus, which we sold out of pretty quickly, is we sold garlic for the first time. And garlic is a bulb. You plant it in the fall just like you plant everything else. And so that was a new thing that we tried, and it was very successful. So I think we'll probably be doing that in future years as well.
What other bulbs do you have?
We have what we have left are a lot of different tulips. We've got lilies that are left. The great thing about lilies is they keep coming back year after year. It has to some of the tulips. At the garage sale, we'll have dwarf irises. They almost look, when they come up, they almost look like somebody just dropped the iris on the ground because they're just so little and the iris is so big, they just barely come up and it's all flower. We'll have some crocus that will be at the garage sale. We'll have some tulips that will be at the garage sale. So it's a great opportunity to, as I say, give your future self a gift. So you'll forget about when you're planted this year, and then when they come out next spring, it's a nice surprise to see that color coming up either through the snow or into the early spring when things are still lightly green, and you get this nice pop of color that will be that gift for your future self. We spend the money that we spend or that we get from this go back into community projects. So Rotary is all about service above self. And so the money that the Juneau Gastrointestinal Club raises from this go back into a variety of different projects. So we in the past have helped fund the kitchen over at Zach Gordon Youth Center and the improvements that happened there. We've been actively involved with the Jensen Olson Arboretum. We built the kiosk out there. We built a beautiful little sitting area off to the side of the Jensen Arboretum. We'll be working with them on their expansion of their parking lot in the next year. You may have heard about the Housing First project that had their opening today. The four Rotary clubs in Juneau all got together and created a work project to build the beds for the Housing First project. We also, the four clubs, have been involved in doing playgrounds. So we helped redo the playground at Auk Bay School, at Riverbend School. So we're really out there trying to do improvements for the community.
What about those people who like tulips and other kinds of bulbs but don't have the time to put them in the ground, don't know how to do it?
Oh, that's great. We have what we call the power planters. So we will go out for $40 an hour and we will plant, and we can plant in an hour probably about 100 bulbs. So we will plant them for you and dig it up. You tell us where you want to do it. We'll dig it up. We'll put the fertilizer in and we'll plant those bulbs for you. We also, if you don't have space for bulbs, we have a donation, and we will then take the bulbs we have and plant them in public places. So if you look at the roundabout in Douglas, there's bulbs there that we planted as a community planting. We planted them at the Pioneers Home. We planted them at the Adult Day Bridge Program. We planted them at the roundabout at Auk Bay along the edges. Those are all Rotary bulbs. So we try and brighten the community, too, and have public planting. So it's a way that you can support Rotary and what we want to do in the community and also color the community come springtime in public places.
So you've convinced people. How do they get the bulbs?
So you can go to rotarybulbs.com. You can see what we have available. I'd encourage you to go in. You need to go in by next Monday. We close the website down on Monday because then we have the garage sale the following Saturday. So if you want to wait and see what we have at the garage sale, that is on September 30th. You can get them there, or you can get them online right now through next Monday.
Kim Kiefer, thank you very much for calling.
Thank you, Jeff.
This is Bird Note. Emperor penguins thrive in the most frigid regions of Antarctica. To feed themselves and their chicks, they chase down fish and squid in the icy ocean. Getting into the sea is easy. They simply slide along on their bellies to the edge of the ice and plunge in headfirst. It's getting back out that's the tricky part. How to haul that plump 80-pound body up and over an icy ledge several feet high while avoiding the attention of nearby predators like hungry leopard seals. Underwater video of the penguins reveals how they do it. As it's swimming briskly upward toward the surface, a penguin releases a layer of air bubbles from under its feathers. These act like a lubricant, reducing friction between the bird's body and the water. Surrounded by this film of air, the penguin's upward thrust increases, and it launches itself out of the water like a feathered torpedo up and over that icy ledge and onto the safety of land. It's just one of the adaptations that allows the emperor penguin to survive in one of the most hostile environments on the planet. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Support for Bird Note comes from Songbird Coffee, offering bird-friendly, organic, shade-grown coffees for over 20 years. Learn more at birdnote.org/songbird.
Winter is coming, bringing forth 8 evenings of art, community, and fun. The Juno Arts and Humanities Council with KTOO Public Media proudly present Art Glasses. Sip and paint, feed and craft, and more at these monthly events. Our first endeavor, Painted Growlers with artist Tana Peters on October 12th and 13th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Alaskan Brewing Company in Lemon Creek. All supplies are included in a no-host bar. Tickets on sale September 20th at the Jack, KTOO, or JAHC.org.
Ya-m. Those are the Russian letters incised on the front of an Aleutic whaling lance at the Alaska State Museum in Juneau. These letters might be the initials of the whaler, a very special kind of whaler.
They were shamans who hunted whales.
Patrick Saltonstall is curator at the Aleutic Museum in Kodiak. Patrick explains that slate lances like this one have been manufactured on Kodiak for 5,000 years and used to hunt whales for at least 2,500 years. However, the archaeological record indicates a shift.
In the late prehistoric period, you do not find any whaling gear in a typical archaeological site. And that's because it's kept in caves, it's kept in secret villages where people lived apart from the rest of society.
Aleutic whalers practiced many secretive rituals in order to assure the success of the hunt.
And they'd use mummy or human fat mixed with aconite, monkshood root. In our Western world, we like, of course it's the aconite that kills them. But I bet you if you asked an Aleutic hunter, he'd say, no, it's the mummy fat. You know, the more important the person you use the fat for, the stronger the poison.
Perhaps an important person like Alexander Baranov, chief manager of the Russian-American company. One ethnographer who visited Kodiak in the 1850s reported that a whaler once told Baranov that he would dig up Baranov's body when Baranov died. It was meant as a compliment. Baranov, by the way, was buried at sea. But this interaction between the shamanic whaler and Baranov leads us to the Cyrillic letters on the face of the lance at the museum.
And so there's this kind of hidden history of actually pretty intensive use of whales and whale products throughout the history of Russian America. In fact, whale meat was absolutely crucial to the survival of Russians. They called it kolonialnaya pishchi, or colonial foods, that included like sea lion meat and whale meat.
That's Ryan Jones, associate professor of history at the University of Oregon. Here he describes the Russian-American policy regarding the whales that Aleutic and Unangan hunted.
And basically what they did was they laid claim to half of any whale that was killed or salvaged. They used that half of the whale then to supply the crucial elements for Baidarka building, especially whale sinews. That was, in their estimation, an irreplaceable part. And so it was of the whale, an irreplaceable part of the Aleutic economy, and of course crucial to the company because they depended on that labor to catch sea otters. So the whale was a crucial part of the kind of economic policy of the Russian-American company.
Like Jones says, the whale products were used to make baidarkas, which is the Siberian word for kayaks, and the meat was then distributed to Russian outposts and hunting camps. Saltonstall has found examples of this, too, in Kodiak's archaeological record.
We did excavate that village from about this sort of workstation from about 1830 over at Cliff Point, and it was kind of neat. We found they were clearly hunting foxes and fishing for cod for the Russian America Company, but we did find whale barnacles. No whale bone, but whale barnacles, which I thought was really cool because it clearly indicates that the Russian American Company was probably supplying these people with whale meat. Didn't find the whale, direct evidence for the whale, but we found these barnacles that only grow on humpback whales.
Within this Aleutic lance with Cyrillic letters on exhibit at the Alaska State Museum, one can see the story of Aleutic shamanism, Aleutic and Russian food, and get a sense of the economy of Russian America, an economy that depended greatly on the skills, labor, and goods of Aleutic people. This is Anjali Grantham in Juneau.
Steves. I believe the more we know and understand about our world, the more fun it is to explore. We're all in the same traveler's school of hard knocks, and it's okay to share notes. Let's spend an hour each week exploring the places and people that make our world so inviting, and share tips that help turn our travel dreams into smooth and affordable reality. Join us for Travel with Rick Steves, Sunday afternoons at 3 on KTOO.
There's something new in the air. It's a little soul, it's a little jazz, and it's a little bit more. And hey, this is Nod here, and I'm here every Friday night from 9 to 11. Won't you join me for Far True Radio, and I promise you, you'll be glad you did. Friday nights at 9 p.m., KRNN-FM.